What I wanted to spend a little time on today, which is sort of the next thing in the Gemara that we were up to, and it also relates to the Makoros, it's the beginning of that, was to take a chance to introduce you to Asei Tosefta. I'm doing it at this juncture because it comes up. It's right there in front of us. This is not the... It's a good example, although there are more interesting examples of when funny things happen to braises in the citation in the Talmud Bavli. What I think, I assume all of you have, if you didn't get a copy during Seder, but that should, almost everybody should have gotten there, if you left the remainder copies there of the Tosefta. what we'll do is we're going to read the Gemara, just to finish it up, so we'll see how it was used. But then I want to reconsider what exactly was in the braisa. Now again, the Bavli quotes a braisa, but if you look in the Tosefta, even the Tosefta in the back of our Gemara, it doesn't look exactly the same as the braisa cited in the Bavli, and it's not without consequences or ramifications. So let's first start with the Gemara on Daf Beis and the Beis. Amiel, can I impose upon you to read? Is that okay? Starting with the, I think we're up to the Meis today. Okay, so that's a an interesting expression. Rabbi Yehuda's machshir ad arba'im v'chamishim ama. Now that's the formulation is interesting for two reasons. What are the two reasons that formulation is interesting? Daniel. So you've actually managed to capture the two questions really in one, which is there actually a limit? And that's why, now, is there a limit? And if there is a limit, which is it? Right? You know, it's sort of like, you know, if your mother or your wife asks you, can you get me like two or three bags of flour? So certainly as a good male, the question you ask is, what? Come on, imagine this is happening. Exactly. It's a little like cooking. My wife has explained to me, see, baking you have to be precise. If you don't do the recipe, fairly precisely, it will come out poorly. Cooking, cooking... many of the things we eat, because like how much do you put in? Like a pinch. What's a pinch? Right. So this is the same thing. In other words, 40 or 50. It's a question that the Gemara says nothing about here. Tosfos does. I didn't ask you to look at this Tosfos. Just be aware of this. It's the kind of question the Gemara often asks. The Gemara in Shabbos, and I don't know, it might be 18th Perek, Perek Mefanin, maybe 18th or 19th Perek, I think it's the 18th. Sam says that Mefanin dalid ohe kupo shel tevin neho orchim, or something like that. So the Gemara wants to know, if you're allowed to be mefana hey, and we're not worried about the Tirchah Shal Tzorah, kal v'chomer dalet. So what is this dalet o hey? There are some places the Gemara says, kid da amri inshi. The kid da amri inshi, the way people talk. Right? Now, we would say, get me a few is the same ambiguity. Right? Can you get me, a few onions? Okay. How many is a few? I think your wife eventually learns to say, X number of, or sometimes you have to say, okay, please get 5 medium-sized onions, okay? But that's important, right, as opposed to a few onions. So the Gemara says sometimes it's good to amri inshi. It means that there's no limit. In other words, arbaim, v'chamisha mama, yeah. Whatever, 60, 70, good too. Sometimes the Gemara draws a chiluk, right, and says, no, dalid in this case, but hey in that case. Okay. So here, it's not insignificant, the numbers. The numbers could have been significant. They're not. They may not be. Why could they have been significant? I don't know if any of you saw the Gemara in Eiruvin, but yes, no. Rav, both in the Bavli and in the Yushalmi, one version, it said Stam, one version in the name of Rav. The opening passage of Yushalmi, which I don't expect you to have gotten to yet, claims that the Chachamim model it upon the Pischol Shel Heichal, which was 20 amos tall and 10 amos wide, and Rabbi Yehuda modeled it on the Pesach of the Ulam. The Ulam, the way, I think I'm regularly going to need to have markers here, unfortunately. The markers AWOL. The way the Ulam, what, you had the Beis HaMikdash, which was 20 wide, 60 deep, if you're looking from the front, and maybe 100 high. In front of the Heichal, you had the Ulam. It was like the mane of a lion. It sort of extended out beyond, on each side, the Heichal. So the Heichal was bigger, at least certainly the front surface. It wasn't that deep. It was probably 10 amos space in the Heichal. So the Heichal had a bigger Pesach, 40 by 20. So if, in fact, Rav is correct, that Chachamim lo lomdua elemi pischol shel Heichal, and Rabbi Yehuda only learned from the Pesach of the Ulam, then the 40 is nice, but the 50 isn't so nice. The Yushalmi has another traditional name of Bar Kapara, even Mea Amah. Right? And Arbaim O Chamishim would certainly suggest that there's no particular limit. So, fine. So now continue. Okay, so what? There's a story. Everybody loves stories. They're very popular today. Heleni Hamalka. Who was Heleni Hamalka? Helene of Adiabene, which was, she was apparently, it seems, a ruler over a couple of cities, somewhere in Mesopotamia, in Assyria, and with the city was described. She appears to have been to have converted. We know of her from a couple other places in rabbinic literature. I was able to quickly, when somebody asked me, find two. One I knew, one I had forgotten. The one that I knew was she was the one who donated the Nevreshes Shel Zahav that used to sit on top of the Heichal so that when the sun would shine, everybody knew it was time for Zman Kriya Shma. It's a Gemara and Yoma. It's a Mishkan Yoma and a Gemara there. And then she's also cited in a story related to a Mishnah Nazir. The din is that Nazirus applies everywhere. If you're taking a letter of Nazirus in Chutz Laretz, you're also bound. But the halacha also is that the Chachamim would go there, Tumas Eretz Ha'amim, Tumas Meis, Midrabanan, on all of Chutz Laretz, for whatever the reasons or whatever the stages of the Gzeira. And therefore, someone who was took a nether of Nazirus and went to Chutz Laretz, it's like they became Tameid on those that Nazirus. So Midrabanan, they required when they would go to Eretz Yisrael, let's say someone who lived in Chutz Laretz took a nether of Nazirus. When they make Aliyah, they have to keep their Nazirus over. The question is, do you have to do the story is that she took a neder of Nazirus for 7 years if her children would sons would come back alive from war. And they did. So she was a Nazira. It's actually a famous question. Rav Shechter likes to ask, apparently. I don't know, likes to ask, but it's the famous Kolo Bechina, and a Kol Entrance Bechina question. Some of you heard this from me. Rav Shechter says, can a woman be a Nazir? What's the answer? It says, you don't need any lambdas for it. But anyway, Heleni Hamalka, and you should also know the six Hashamos, but I won't ask you to name them now. Heleni Hamalka, they're in Ezer Makomot. Heleni Hamalka, we know from that story also, she took an edit of Nesiris, she came to Eretz Yisrael, it's one of the Chumas of Beis Shammai, Beis Shammai said she only needed to keep 30 days, no matter how long Nesiris was. She came to Eretz Yisrael, she already kept the 7 years, she just needed to keep 30 more days in Eretz Yisrael, and Beis Hillel said she had to start all over the beginning of the 7 years. There's even a tradition that she became Tameh at the end of the 7 years, she ended up keeping 21 years in Nesiris. Her hair was probably worth a lot of money at the end, I'll tell you. Although they were pretty wealthy also. Her son, her husband's name, according to the Wikipedia entry, she has a husband or a son, Munbaz. There's a beautiful Gemara about Munbaz Hamela. There's a beautiful Gemara about her. I forget where the Gemara is, but it's, what's that?
There are a couple Gemaras in Shtaras.
No, the sheet, you mean the seventh parak? Munbaz, there's a Munbaz who I imagine must have been her son, especially one of the Talmidei Chachamim, who has a shita about Tino Shanishba, a very important shita. But no, the story about, I don't think this was that Munbaz. Maybe it was her husband, Munbaz HaMelech, in the years of famine. In the years of famine, he basically emptied his family treasuries to support the poor. And the family was very upset with him. Your fathers, your ancestors spent, you know, all this time being gathering these treasures, and you're dispersing them like that. He said, they gathered down below, and I'm being owed their treasures in heavens above, and so on. Whatever. It's a beautiful Gemara. Anyway, so we know, I think that's the only three places I know to find where Hilenia Malka appears. I always know, I thought she's famous, but I think because I know this Gemara for a long time. So anyway, so she, the story is that she sat in the sukkah for, and the sukkah was taller than 20 amos, and the zakenim would we nichnasim v'yotzin l'sham, which implies what, by the way? What's that? In other words, did they happen to visit her? Probably not. It's like the home of the gvir, you know. The Tamid HaChacham are raising funds for the yeshivas. So they're coming in, you know, this Tamil HaChacham or that Tamil HaChacham comes in. You know, I say it a little tongue-in-cheek. But certainly she seems to have had some kind of, call it rabbinic court, it sounds like. Okay, and then they didn't say a word. Right, so that's obviously Lo Kedoros HaRishonim. Doros HaRishonim, unfortunately, there are plenty of so-called gedolim, and only some of them are so-called, you know, or rabbanim who will have plenty to do with gevirim and not give them tochacha, point out things that are also that you're not supposed to be doing, especially if they're giving money to, you know, to their causes. But here the assumption is, of course, if she had been doing something wrong, the chachamim would have said something. That's what's presumed here. It's presumed that that people who have the capacity, you know, to say something are obligated to do so, and failure to do so is wrong. So that, you know, in other words, there's no havamin in the Gemara. Well, it was usher, but they didn't want to say anything to her because they didn't want to offend her. Nope, that was not that wasn't an option for the Gemara. So now the story continues. Okay, so she didn't need a sukkah kshera. Okay, one of the, I'm surprised that nobody has tried to bring, it's a very important machlokas arishonim that one could try to bring a raya from in this. Some of you have, all of you have mothers. Some of you have sisters. Do they make a bracha on the sukkah? I think there are no Sephardim in Shir, right? I welcome them. I always like having someone to make fun of the Ashkenazim to show they don't know how to read Hebrew or things like that, right?
Okay.
What?
It was very good last year.
Who was here last year? Yeah, but Yudi is like, you know, kind of in between. So he was raised as an Ashkenazi. Yeah, it's true. True, but I've had Syrians occasionally, real Syrians in Ashkenazi, who knew, you know, Kiryah. They knew how to read things. So anyway, so except for Sephardim, Ashkenazim is a general rule. So your mothers, your sisters, your daughters, they make bracha on the sukkah. It's a big machlokas arishonim. The machlokas between the Rambam and the Baalei Tosfos. The Rambam held it was shem shemayim levatala. The Baalei Tosfos hold that you can volunteer a bracha even if you're not chayim. But it actually matters here. How could they say the Chachamim said nothing if the sukkah was a sukkah psula, but they still should have said something if Eleni Malka was making brachas? Right? If a woman could make a bracha on a sukkah, then she needed to know at least that her sukkah was psula. Okay, just pointing out. No, but they would have known that as a good from Jewish woman that she wanted to make brachas when she could, if the halacha allowed it. Right, it's religious participation is important for people. So it's odd. In other words, the fact that she was patur in the sukkah does not mean they shouldn't have said anything. They should have said just in case, you know, you don't have to sit in the sukkah, but realize you can't make a bracha on this. Right, just pointed that. Noah?
You don't assume that she realized that her sukkah was possible.
She had like a view.
She wasn't a Mulumedes. Your grandmother or your great-grandmother, odds are, were probably very, very pious. It was probably a very pious woman. She probably didn't know that a sukkah was psula above 20 amos. Probably lots of things that you learned in fourth grade in a book, she didn't know. Right? Things that rarely come up in your life. But she knew what it was. She knew what piety was. So Hilenia Malka was a Gioris. She didn't get to go to, you know, Yeshivat Noam and then to Mayanot and so on and so forth. So she didn't know. So the Chachamim didn't say anything. They should have said something. So the reason they didn't, the Chachamim say, is because the Chachamim of Harishon didn't say anything because she was Turun Asuka. There was no reason to talk her Chinik. Right? It's not a problem. Okay. Daniel, question?
No.
I haven't seen anybody bring it up. I have, you know, you'd have to go back and look. You know, it would be pretty funny if I forgot, because I have learned that discussion. There's a long tosis in Rosh Hashanah, I think Daf Lamed Gimel by Shofar, and there's a long tosis in Brachos, I think it's about Daf Yudal Malaf, about Hallel, Chatzi Hallel, when Rav came to Bavel and he saw them, whatever that story is. There's a long tosis that I think all of you bet Yudal Malaf. There's at least two of the tosis that talk about this, talk about the issue in general, a volunteer in the Brachos. So those are two places I would look to see if anybody bothers to cite the fact that the Chachamim's could not, they shouldn't have been silent, even if she was Turim and Asoka. That'd be interesting if I forgot that. I mean, I've forgotten a lot of things, but yes. Okay, was it Zach a question or no? No, okay. All right, so the story continues. So now continue. Okay, so they said two things. Number one, she had seven sons. That's very nice. And also, so Maser, she did everything al pi chacham. Then later, when we look at the Tosefta in Yerushalmi, this is the part where things really go in a very different direction. Right? But she had seven sons. That might be a stylized number. Okay, it might not be, you know, halo anachi tov lach mi shiva banim, right? That's a very common expression. It's by Elkanah, Tachana, by, I think it's in Rus also. Asher hitov alach mishiva banim. So I don't know if she had literally seven sons. If the historians record for us that they have, I know where you're coming. I know what you're going to ask. You're going to ask me that one of them must have been a gadol. Then if you ask me, so okay, you don't have to have seven sons. You can have five sons. And some of one was a gadol also. Yes.
No, I thought that in the Gemara Nazir mentions like more details about her children, her sons.
There is this famous story in Gittin Kamsa Bar Kamsa, the woman and her seven sons.
Yeah, that's
not. No, but I'm not. You know, maybe it's possible. Okay, you have to look at. That's probably the.
I'm out of nausea for a while.
Okay. Yes. Hello. Any questions? Yehuda.
Quick correction. I think, unless I'm really radically mistaken, it's a little
bit public on the Asarabanin. Okay. Fine. I apologize. Then it's from Russ. Okay. Fine. You might be right. You do have Arakara Yoda Shiva and Rabas Banim Mlala, but that doesn't make any sense. Okay. So anyway, so they said number one, she had seven sons. Number two, she did everything according to the words of the sages. So the Gemara asks. Yes, by definition, how long does it take to have seven children? Seven sons. You can have seven sons a little faster than you can have seven daughters. Why? There's a week longer tumah automatically for Nekeva. Okay, so anyway, it takes, you know, it doesn't take quite, you can do it probably about 56 months or something like that. I mean, you can't really. I mean, it's never going to happen. What? If I think, yeah, correct. But they weren't assuming that teretz, right? Then there would have been no.
Some chocolates, you probably would have died.
They probably would have died. Faster than that. She might not have died, but they would have died. She might have miscarried. I don't know, you know, I think triplets are pretty rare in nature, and beyond that is probably virtually non-existent. So, anyway. So, Mistama, though, normally when, in an era in which the formula was not available, so it would have been highly unlikely that a woman would have had a child more than every 18 months or something like that. So one has to assume that while you start counting from the birth of the first child, that's how the clock starts, six more children you have to assume was probably like 9 years or something like that at a minimum. Again, I suspect that the seven may be a little bit stylized, but if she had four children, the odds are pretty good one of them wasn't Sarach Me'ima either. You can probably assume something to the tune of 5-6 years, and one of whom could have stayed overnight with daddy in the sukkah. That would have been a choice. Zach?
That's the age, 5 or 6.
Probably. Yeah. I mean, a katan sheina tzarech la'imo, yeah.
Do we not, does no one like, later on tell us that nowadays that's this age?
I don't know. I know. Again, it's you think about it. If you had a child, you know, how old would he have to be before he could sleep in the sukkah with you, without his mother? The answer is probably not. You don't need to be older than 5 or 6. Probably a little younger than that. So bottom line is, they said she must have had children who were mechuyavos in sukkah. Not mechuyavim in sukkah, but there was a mitzvah chinuch. Okay, and then v'chitema. Which is a crazy havamina. In other words, are you going to say that it's only midrabanan? I could have said much better than that, but she's going to say it's only midrabanan. She didn't hold the drabanans. You know, when a ger comes to convert, so they're not allowed to refuse to accept any mitzvah. And they say, afilu dikduk echon midivrei sofrim. Now, I don't think the Gemara in Bechoros talks about the Rabbanans. And when the Rambam quotes it, a dittu kecha midivrei sofrim probably doesn't mean the Rabbanans, it means the Raisas. A ger who would not accept the Rabbanans, the Chor is not a ger. What kind of Jews are we?
Rabbinic.
We are rabbinic Jews. And the notion of not holding the Rabbanans, it's not, you're going to ask me, well, what are you violating? Aside from the Ramban, you're violating the principle of, Ramban, you're not violating Los Sosur. It's not clear what the power of Chacham makes Xeris are. Los Sosur is the power to interpret Dinam Daraisa. The Rambam assumes that all Xeris Darabanan are assumed Los Sosur. According to the Ramban, you'll say that he or she is a good convert? No. What defines us about, you know, if you took away all the Darabanans, our religion wouldn't look like anything that it actually does. So it's a funny kind of habit. It's obviously rejected. I could have said something better, I think, of what you would have tainted about what Homa Salah Sapi Chacham, and maybe it's not as good with the answer. What were you going to say, Alter? That's what I would have said. In other words, you would have said it wasn't her responsibility, so it wasn't our job. So Lechora, if the father's not there, if the father wasn't here, the mother should take care of Chinuch. You know, if you ask the rabbi, am I mechuyevus technically in chinuch? I don't know, but of course you raise your children. You know, as it is, mothers are mostly responsible anyway for setting the religious tone. Morty.
Is there any opinion that chinuch doesn't apply to midrabanan?
No, but this would be a chinuch on a daraisa. You can't, it's not, in other words, the mitzvah sukkah here is daraisa, it's just that he's a katan, not a bar chiyuva.
Yeah.
There might be differences about, I don't remember, by katan ochon nevelos based the mitzvah of Frisho or machil katan nevelos by the rabbanans, but not, this is the raisa, your ear.
I'm going to see what Shadon Hachos. If a woman goes to court and says, I want to keep every single biblical mitzvah, as interpreted by the rabbis, but I don't like the rabbanans,
yeah.
Would she be a kosher ger?
I think not. That's what I'm saying. I think intuitively, no. For the Rambam, he would say it's a rejection of Los Osos, so she's not accepting all them. But even for the Ramban, in other words, it's kind of like, it's the same taina that people had that Kabbalah Samitzvah isn't required for Geirus. You know, according to, it's only Mila Tfila and Hartzah Asdamim. And the Rambam doesn't state that Kabbalah Samitzvah is a requirement. Now, I actually think the Rambam holds it isn't Ma'akev. I don't want to get into this. It's a long discussion to be had, but it's well known the Rav took a very, very hard line in Lamdus and Halacha on this issue. And the claim is a fundamentally, firstly, the Shulchan Aruch holds it's Ma'akev, so it shouldn't really matter. It doesn't matter what the Rambam Shita is. So I don't Chas V'Shalom disagree with the Maskana, but for other reasons. But the point, why is a Kabbalah Samitzus required in Ma'akev, and even if you didn't list it, why is it? Because that's the definition of Geirus. Right? The definition of Geirus is Kabbalah Samitzus. Right, so that's why it may not be. It could be you don't have a formalistic requirement. We do, but it could be you could envision the halacha stating you need mila, you need tefila, you need a karbon when there's a mikdash. You don't need kabbalah samitzus because that is the definition of geirus. Geirus means comes. You want to be part of the Jewish people. Being part of the Jewish people means you do what Jewish people do. What Jewish people do is they keep mitzvahs, and they keep the rabbanans too because that's part of being a rabbinic Jew. If you want to convert to Karaism, that would be a good place for them to convert, and they wouldn't even have to accept rabbinic interpretations of the daraisas. Dan, you had a question before.
I was going to say, why can't this line be saying that she's not a Karaite?
Because there were no Karaites then. And there might have been Sadducees, but Zach?
Is it
That's it. Stop a second. I that you almost said the joke. That's actually not a that's not a crazy suggestion. I doubt that's what's going on here, but that's not bad actually. Zach?
Was this like a time when the like I guess the struggle between like the Siddiqui and the Prussian was?
It's at the dates in the Wikipedia article on Hileni are she died around the year 56. And converted, I think, around the year 30 or something like that, sometime in that neighborhood. So there were Sadducees around. I don't know what the dynamic of the Sadducees and the Pharisees were in the last few decades of the Second Temple. That's towards the end of the Bais Sheni period, yeah. Yeah. There were some, Naomi, you had a question? You can pass you on. I thought you
totally forgot what it was.
That's fine. You remember it as soon as I get the next one. Gail. And then you'll ask it.
Why are you saying it's because she's a Gila? Maybe it's because she's a Malka. It's a Kara of Malka type thing. But having tall sukkot makes you look more impressive to the other kings, and lets you save your people better. And so therefore,
Daniel, you had a question. I'm sorry, Yehuda. Yehuda, could you knock some sense into him during morning seder so that in Shuna? Yeah, yeah.
If part of the story is that they're abundant in sin, then who cares if she was listening or not? Like, even if she doesn't hold the verbanans, their abundance still should have.
So that's a different question. So there, so the weather of the mitzvah tochacha, which I don't want to talk about now, is not so pashut if the person's not going to listen. That's a whole discussion of when do you say there's a mitzvah tochacha, when do you say mutav shiyu shogim mayu mizidin. Sometimes it's counterproductive, right? When you're mechanech a child, when you raise a child, there are many issues that you may need to address to your child in terms of his or her chinuch at different stages, before and after bar and bat mitzvah. Right? And as a parent, you have to use the wisdom to know what to push and what not to push. You have to give them space to grow, you know, and even if they don't do everything they're supposed to do, or they're doing things they shouldn't do, you have to figure out how much you can be amiss on them, how much you can load them up with, you know, how much you can push them, and when to push and when not to push. So I don't think it's... I think that's a broad question within the midst of hocheach tochiah, of it may only be when it's effective. So they may have decided that it really, you know, she was a Gioris, and generally Gioruses tend to be Gioruses who convert L'shem Shamayim, and I assume Hileni Hamalka did because she didn't convert L'shem Shulchan Malachim. She didn't convert to marry a Jewish guy. So I assume that she, you know, Gioruses who convert L'shem Shamayim can be very, very, very firm. Even those who convert Shalom L'shem Shamayim, they're typically firmer than the men they're converting to marry. And sometimes even they break up, the Gioris continues to be firm and the guy was never firm. Sometimes. So it's a fair assumption that that they're working with is that if in fact she had a Mechieves and they told her, she would have listened. No.
This is a bit longish, but couldn't you make a distinction between, let's say, Brit Shel Abraham and Brit Sinai, and you could accept one and not the other?
No. There is no, there are only, as far as I know in halacha, there are only two categories. There's ger toshav and there's ger tzedek. And a ger toshav has to accept the sheva mitzvos, even though every guy is mechuyim in it, but to be a ger toshav, and he can't say except for gezel, and a ger tzedek has to accept every one of the mitzvos and the interpretations of the chachamim. And I take it as a given. I don't want to spend time, I know that everybody thinks you learn Masecha Sukkah, and it's just a way, because you really want to do Lundus. If you do the third parak, then you do Merubah. What do you do? If you do the first parak, we could do Shabbos and Erev. We'll do some Shabbos and Erev, but let's bring it back to this. Yair, Morty, and then Daniel.
Within the original text of the Brit, before the Gemara starts, interpreting it,
yeah.
We see the line, is it possible that it means that she was makbid on keeping the mitzvah she was Turin?
What I would say it means, so if I wanted to interpret pshat in that line, is really answer a different question, which is sort of Yehuda's and someone else's, is that she followed the Chachamim's instructions. So you can't say they didn't say anything because they didn't want to offend her, and she was an important person, and they felt it was better mutiv shu shogim mizidin. Because kol ma'aseh lo asa so el api chacham.
But it's already an implicit assumption.
It is, but the Babli, but the text of the Brice that the Babli has may be spelling that out. Right.
So you're assuming she consulted those directions before she made the sukkah?
No, but I'm assuming that even if she didn't, because how do you make a sukkah? Do you go to the rabbi and say, Rabbi? When I was first Masadir Kiddushin, first time, I went to my Rebbe, Rishak, and I said, Rebbe, do you have a few minutes? Because I wanted to sit down. I mapped out, what I've seen at weddings, how you do a wedding, and so on. And I had a bunch of questions. I stole my notes from that conversation, and all the answers. And those are my instructions of how I do a wedding, what I do, what things I do, things I don't do, and so on. You go to make a sukkah. You don't nudge the poor rabbi and say, Rabbi, can we sit down? I'd like to build a sukkah. Can you tell me how to build a sukkah? It's
well,
like, no, you
look. Even if she's a Giora, then she doesn't know, you know, everything about everything.
She went into our local sukkah store and bought a sukkah. She bought the deluxe kind. Maybe this, the shopkeeper didn't know too much either. So the bottom line is, she built a sukkah, right? You don't assume that she can, you know, you look, Jews build a sukkah. So she's a queen. She has a little more extra resources. So she decided, hit her mitzvah, she was going to build a big sukkah, right? Because that's a bigger kvod shanayim. Not realizing that there's a technical psul if it's above 20 amos. That's all.
Okay.
Morning. Correct. It is. I don't know that they. I don't know if any of the Rishonim say it here. It comes up later in the Masechta. They say that if you don't have one of the Arba Minim, or maybe it's said here. There they talk. You don't want Arba Minim. You don't put something else in instead. The Minim Achmed Zezah. And I don't know if it's there. They say even for Tinoch, or it's in response to somebody. Did somebody say it here? I don't remember. But yes, you cannot fulfill Chinuch. You cannot fulfill Chinuch if it is if you're not mekayim the mitzvah properly. I'm going to tell you the tshuva. I will not answer any questions about it. And I think that there's much that can be challenged in it. But if you want to see the principles, where Moshe Feinstein, when he talks about in his tshuva coeducation for little children, one of the questions he raises is that since you can't fulfill the mitzvah when they're older, in you know, and bnei chiyuva in mixed company, perhaps it's not chinuch either if you do it in mixed company. I don't want to get into the there are lots of questions there, but I believe in that tshuva, if I'm not mistaken, takes the same principle he's working with, that if you wouldn't be the mekayim the mitzvah when you're a gadol like this, then you can't do chinuch that way. It's not, truth is, it's mistabra anyway. Bad chinuch to teach the child what not to do. Daniel.
And also, why does it say that like she had seven sons and not to the husband? Which we know
so it sounds like, I don't know if her husband converted along with her.
We said the muvah is the whole thing with the charity.
No, so firstly, that could have been her son. It could have been her husband too. The goyim who give tzedakah also. The goyim who are tzaddikim also. So it's not impossible. More than the realm of possible. Okay, fine. So now the Gemara says, continue. So therefore, okay, so we can agree. In other words, she would have done everything properly. That's fairly straightforward. And if she had seven sons, and let's assume, as the Bavli is assuming, that they are young children, but at least one of them must have reached the age of Chinuch. Therefore, it must have been, Rabbi Yehuda says, a kasher sukkah. And the fact that it was tall in 20 amos shows that, in fact, the sukkah was sukkah's kshera. So, what emerges from this brisa, before the Gemara continues, is that whatever kind of sukkah Hileni Hamalka was sitting in must have been the kind of sukkah that Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim would argue about. When Rav, earlier on the page, gave three ukimtos, limiting the machlokas hatanoim to situations, whatever they were, of those situations, this sukkah of Hileni Hamalka, for each ukimta, could not have been that kind of a sukkah. In other words, for Rabba, for the first statement of Rav, whoever it was, Rabbi Yoshia, for Rabbi Yoshia, this could not have been a sukkah with the fanos hamagios l'schach. Because if it were, what kind of a raya would Rabbi Yehuda have been bringing against the sheet of the Chachamim? They agree in that case. According to Rav Huna, it cannot have been a case of a sukkah larger than Dalan Adal Amos. Why? Because otherwise, what kind of a raya would Rabbi Yehuda have been bringing against the Chachamim? The Chachamim would have agreed once the sukkah was Dalan Amos. And finally, the one that's impossible to be holy, as Rashi ultimately says, and I think Tosus does also, if the sukkah was larger than Machzik Rosh Haruvo V'Shulchano, which would hold seven people anyway, it virtually certainly has to have been. If that was the case, how could Rabbi Yehuda bring a raya from Hileni Hamalka sukkah against the Chachamim if they agree? As the crucial point is, if you say that there are some sukkahs to which the Chachamim are moded to Rabbi Yehuda, that cannot be the sukkah that the Brice is talking about. Otherwise, Rabbi Yehuda would not have been bringing a raya. Now, the truth is, it could have been. It could have been. It could have been that the sukkah, it is possible that the Chachamim agree with Rabbi Yehuda by a sukkah whether the fanus and magirus l'schach. And it is possible that Hilenia Malka sat in a sukkah whether the fanus and magirus l'schach. And nonetheless, Rabbi Yehuda could have said what he said to the Chachamim. You know why? There's an answer the Gemara could have given, which it doesn't. But you should be elsewhere in Shas, the Gemara will pull this out of its pocket. But it's when the Gemara is trying to explain that a machlokas is limited between two tanan, a known machlokas is limited to certain circumstances, and there's evidence from the dialogue of one to the other that, in fact, it applies to even those circumstances, a broader set, what does the Gemara sometimes answer? It says that Rabbi Yehuda didn't understand what the Chacham was saying. He thought they were, say, X, and therefore he responded in kind. But it really, we have the Chacham Amoda. Now that's a last resort answer, right? You could have said that Rabbi Yehuda thought the Chacham held that any sukkah above 20 amos is possible because of sukkah diras arayi ina. And the maskana is a no, that they didn't understand. Yes, he didn't understand that.
Why can't we just say there's ambiguity, you know, regarding the tzivut?
No. There's a separate question. A couple of you were bugging me in Seder. I don't think it wasn't you. Somebody else. Somebody asked me in Seder, somebody who shall go nameless, I think I remember who they were, isn't the story Araya against Rava? Right? And the answer to the question then is absolutely, categorically, not. Rava is the simplest shita. Rava says, what kind of a sukkah do the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda argue on it's kashrus when it's about 20 amos? What kind of sukkah here?
Any sukkah.
Every sukkah. Any sukkah. Right? So I don't care whether Hilenia Malka's sukkah was 1,000 feet tall or 5 feet tall, you know, 60 miles wide, 6 feet wide. I don't care if it had pink and purple polka dots on the canvas on the side or was made out of wood and plants were growing. It doesn't matter. Any sukkah above 20 amos, according to the Chachamim Aliba the Rava, is psula. And therefore, it's shayach. If Rabbi Yehuda claims that the sukkah was above 20 amos, he was right for being a raya from the story. And then the dialogue continues. Now, Lamaskona, you have a question. According to the Chachamim, let's say like Rava, how do they deal with the story of Hilenia Malka? The answer to that question is, I don't know, but the Tosefta itself is, what the Chacham hold? Presumably they said, you're wrong. Our sukkah wasn't above 20 amos. And when they said to him, she was an isha, maybe they meant, you know, even if it was above 20 amos, it wouldn't have been an isha. But we think you're wrong. Or we think the Chachamim did say something to her, and she lowered it. Right? In other words, I don't know what the Chachamim will answer for Rabbi Yehuda, but the Tosefta in every version, and the Yerushalmi in its story, and the Bavli Aliba the Rava, leave that thing open. We don't know exactly what the Chachamim would say. Presumably, they think that Rabbi Yehuda got something wrong in the story. That's usually how it goes. It's not spelled out. It happens to be that in this one answer the Bavli is going to give for Rabbi Zeira, they're going to work out to explain what they were. They're still debating a fact. They're debating where her children were sitting. Right? There's still a machlokas about it. At the end of the day, there's a machlokas about the history, about the story between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim. But just understand that according to Rava, The Bryce is simple. You don't have to ask any questions. You don't have any discussion. I don't care what Hilenia Malka, what a queen's sukkah typically looks like. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter whether it's big, it's small, it's tall, it's short, it's light, it's dark. It makes no difference. Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim, according to Rabbi, will argue about it, and therefore it's relevant for Rabbi Yehuda to bring a raya. But if you claim that the machlokas between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim is limited to a certain kind of sukkah, and that kind of sukkah is the sukkah kind of sukkah, that it is inconceivable that a Malka would sit in that sukkah, then you're wrong, because Rabbi Yehuda should never have brought his araya to the Chacham. Now, as I said earlier, a few minutes ago, the Gemara would have had a teretz in that case also, that Rabbi Yehuda savar that the Chacham held for reason X. But really, he held for reason Y. In other words, it could have, but that's a last resort teretz. We'd rather have them say something more meaningful. So now the Gemara says, okay, continue, Amiel. Bishlama. Shum avira. Yeah, you want air, you want cross currents. The Yerushalmi has a nicer expression. It says, Karira Ayil. Is that what it says? It's the Yerushalmi's expression. It's not there. Okay. Yes, Diyai Karira Ayil. You know what that means? It means that the cool air, the Karira, better is Yoe, like Kilona Ayil enters. In other words, the cool air circulates better when you have, you know, a gap between the Nefanis and the Tzach. You get both the shade. The best thing is to be in the shade and in a breeze. Those are the best, that's the way you keep cool. So then, if you want to argue, if you want to hold like Rava, that because you have to be able to see the Tzach, and if the Nefanis Magiris Tzach, you will see the Tzach. But if the Nefanis are not Magiris Tzach, you won't, and that's the argument. It is very conceivable that Hileni Hamalka was sitting in such a sukkah, because kings and queens enjoy as much comfort as we do. However, Ella. But in a sukkah gedola, beyond Dalar Adalar Amos, everybody agrees. Okay. Doesn't make sense. It's inconceivable that Hileni Hamalka sukkah was Dalar Adalar Amos. I mean, even argue that if it's Chachamim Nechnasim Miyotzim, Sham, that it probably was much larger than Dalar Adalar Amos. You know, they're not having Yechidus with the Rebbe, where you want maybe a very small room. And I'm sure the Rebbe's rooms, even when you have Yechidus with the Rebbe, is not so small. Right? So that's not what's going on here. So there's no way she's sitting in a small sukkah. So the Gemara says, Amar. Right. So I think that the Gemara didn't understand this response initially, and they asked a question, but it's really clarifying. No, it's a sukkah composed of compartments. Ah, it's a big sukkah. It's many, it's 50 amas by 50 amas, but it's all compartments, small ketonias, right? Less than dalar amas or dalar amas. So the Gemara says, v'chidarka. No, of course the sukkah is like peso. You have a wide open space for eating, you have one space which was her living room and one space which was her dining room, and then you had little rooms around the side. That might have been, how much room do you need to sleep in comfortably? A bed is typically 6 feet by 1.5 feet. Dalan Amos by 3 amos is plenty of room to have your private chamber that you just sleep in. So that you had rooms for privacy, or you might put a little desk and a chair in where you can work quietly. Right? Helene was writing her conversion memoirs that she was writing, so she wanted that quiet space inside in the sukkah. She could be disturbed always by those rabbis, you know, hacking her chaynik and trying to raise funds. So she instead, she had a little private space that she wanted. So the point is that, in other words, Hileni Hamalka, the sukkah was a big sukkah, it was kshera, but there were parts of it which had ketonios. And that's what Rabbi Yehuda was trying to bring a raya from those ketonias, which apparently she must have been sitting in. So the Gemara says, okay, Rabbi Yehuda Savar. So it still boils down to a machlokas and metzias of what happened. Rabbi Yehuda says that the children used to hang out with her and eat, you know, at least in her one of her ketonios. And the Chacham say, no, she kept the ketonios mishum tzni'usa. I don't think tzni'usa here means a halachic obligation of tzni'us, of kol kavud abas me'al panima. It means, what is tzni'us, by the way? No, tzni'us is not modesty. Let's start with that. Privacy. The best definition of tzni'us, it will be a topic of a sikha at some point, I've spoken about this before. The best definition of tzni'us is a definition given to us by one of our friends. She teaches, she's been teaching a long time. She tells her students, tznius is keeping what is private, private. You might describe it as sometimes modesty klape chutz, but modesty in company is much more, company is something different than tznius. Whereas tznius is really always klape chutz. It means keeping what should be private, private. So tznius is privacy. So she wanted privacy part of the time, right? She didn't, said the rabbis were, you know, we're constantly entering, or people were constantly entering, and she needed her space. She needed her private space. Okay. Or to borrow from Rabbi Schachter's drasha yesterday, she needed her ma'ara. Okay. Fine. Okay. So that's the end of the first part of the first piece in our sugya. So I want to state a few things, just to review very, very, very quickly, and make a comment about the halacha, which we're going to come back to. We're going to come back to, not because the Pesach halacha is so interesting, but the methodology of the Rishonim, and the trying to glue together all the different sugyos in the perek, and trying to pick, is very interesting. But I want to just, so we'll come back to it, but I want to summarize. The Mishnah has a machlokes, Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim, about a sukkah that is gavoa me'esrim amah. It's taller than 20 amos, whether it's ksher or psula. The Mishnah lists three other psulim in the sukkah, nobody disagrees. The Amoraim offer three different reasons as to why a sukkah is psula above 20 amos. Rabbah said, because there's an obligation of seeing the schach, of remembering the man yedu dorshechem ki vasukos of shafti. When you go into the sukkah, you have to know the schach is there. Rav Zeira said that it's so that you should be sitting in the tzel of schach, or at least sitting in a sukkah with schach that is re'uya to cast tzel in the sukkah. And finally, Rava said that the reason why it's psula, if it's built above 20 amos, is because a sukkah built above 20 amos has to be made as a diras keva. And the sukkah has to have an element of arai, or at least ro'oi, either ro'oi to be arai, or typically what people build as arai, for determining the shear of the sukkah. Once you're within the shear of the sukkah, at least the walls you can make of iron. Fine. The Gemara subsequently quotes three ukimtas of Rav, limiting or qualifying the scope of the machlokas between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim. When did the Chachamim say a sukkah is psula if it's above 20 amos? First one, Rav Yoshia in the name of Rav, all in the name of Rav, said if the Tefanos HaMagias L'Schach, the Chachamim agree. And the Gemara suggests that that is really in accordance with Rav Ashita, that if the schach, the walls go up to the schach, your eyes will follow the walls and they'll see the schach, you're fine. The second ukimta, Rav Huna in the name of Rav, said it only applies to a sukkah below Dalet al Dalet Amos. And as the Gemara explains later, everybody here is assuming the shear of sukkah is 7 tvachim by 7 tvachim, Rosh HaVeruba v'Shulchano. And the machlokes is from, according to the second ukimta Rav, is from the minimum shear kashras up until Dalet Amos. Once it has Dalet Amos and Dalet Amos, then the Chacham will agree with Rabbi Huda. And the Gemara suggested that that is in accordance with Rabbi Zeira's Tam, which is that at that point the sukkah is large enough to be getting tzel from the schach, or to be roi for tzel from the schach. And finally, the third ukimta was Rabbi Chanan bar Rabba in the name of Rav, who said the machlokas is only on literally the minimum shear of sukkah. Once it's past the minimum shear of sukkah, then even above 20 amos, the Chachamim agree. We have no idea why that is. Tosa suggests that it's because it's like a loshel tarnagolim. Then the Gemara finally, to try to sort out between these ukimtas, quotes the famous story now, and we're going to explore further now as an exploration of introducing you to Tosefta and the differences how brises are cited and used in the Bavli and Yerushalmi. Quotes the story of Heleni Hamalka, who sat in a sukkah, at least according to Rabbi Yehuda, above 20 amos. And the Gemara points out that a sukkah of a malka is not likely to be one that is very small. It might very well have walls that don't reach the schach, but it is not going to be small. And therefore, it would seem to be inconceivable that like Rabbi Zeira, or like the Ukimta that said it's only if it's less than Dalet al Dalet Amos, but more than Dalet al Dalet Amos, everybody agrees, because Heleni Hamalka sukkah was certainly more than Dalet al Dalet Amos. And the Gemara itself suggests that maybe, it was a sukkah with some private chambers in it, and she sat in those chambers. And the question is, did her children sit with her, or did her children sit outside those chambers? But that's the bottom line. So that's the maskana of the Gemara, as you can be tired of that shita. Rashi assumes it's impossible to make Rabbi Bar Chanan's shita work with the brisa. In other words, there's no way Heleni Hamalka, probably none of the Ketonios either, it could possibly have been that small. Nobody makes a kita. Nobody makes a private space. Amalka certainly doesn't make a private space in her sukkah that's 7 tvachim by 7 tvachim. Just not likely. Just one second. There happens to be, anybody know, what is the Pesach Halacha? I haven't sent you the Maribus numbers. They're waiting for you. They will be next. Pesach Halacha is like which of the Amorim? Rabba, Rabbi Zeira, or Rava?
Rabba. Here are different divisions of machlokas are Rishonim and Bethes. Most Rishonim, the Torah, the Beis Yosef, following himself in the Shulchan Aruch, and we assume that, like Rava, and that any sukkah that's above 20 amos is psula, and no matter what its size, no matter how the walls are constructed, because we assume that the requirement here is to have something that's roi to be a diras arai. Okay. That's the end of this sugya. Were there some questions? And I did not take... Kasser, you had a question?
No.
Yehuda? Okay. No?
What's the nature of the Gemara bringing a maisa as a raya?
It happens a lot. It happens starting in the Mishnah. It's actually... It's not the Gemara. It's the Tosefta. It's very common. If you want to see, you just take a Bar Ilan out and search Masa in the Mishnah. And again, you're going to get some extras that aren't related, but it's also probably Masa space Days with a wild card will help you narrow it down a little bit. You'll see that it's a very, very frequent thing. It's a very, very frequent. Because precedent plays a major role in every legal system. Right, you haven't. If you study halacha with me, for those students who studied halacha with me, the number one rule of Psak Yair is
always
follow the basic. Oh no! It's encompassed by a statement in the Gemara, the last line of the sixth parak of brachos. Puk chaze mai amad devar. The minhag. That is what is usually. Does this sound familiar now?
The concept. Nobody ever establishes this as from a rule.
And this is the way, typically speaking, Psak works. It's why the Mishnah Berurah actually represents a radical departure from the norm of the history of Psak, and the Aruch HaShulchan is very much in accordance with the history of Psak. It has nothing to do with Kula or Chumra. The Aruch HaShulchan is not always Mekel. Mishnah Berurah is usually Machmir. But the Aruch HaShulchan is not always Mekel. But the Aruch HaShulchan consistently defends Minag, even if it means standing on his head. This is the position that begins with the Balei HaTosas. The Rambam was totally opposed to this. The Rambam did not care what the communal Minag as a whole was. If the position wasn't defensible within traditional halachic sources from the Bavli and the Gaonim, the Rambam did not care. It was wrong. Eventually, the views of the Balei HaTosas seeped into, insidiously, and infected the ways of the later Chachmei Sfarad, like the Ramban and after him. And so ultimately, I think the dominant position has become, probably even amongst later Sephardi authorities, but I won't speak for that as much, that the Minhag is dominant. You want to understand the Rambam's strange ways in Shulchan Aruch, what seems strange positions he often adopts, often the Chumrah, but sometimes crazy Kulas, you just have to understand. Puch Chazi Mayama Dvar. You just have to see, that's the number one rule of Psak, what in fact is the Minhag. Anyway, happens to be here, we paskin like Rava. Again, as I said when I started this, the start of the Gemara, how often do people build sukkahs that are more than 20 amos tall? I don't know, maybe you go out to the Hamptons if they were building a sukkah. Each shul, if they're really more than one real shul, I don't think there's one real shul there, there's a minyanim, each shul would be building, you know what the edifice complex is? It was describing how in the early 20th century, when shuls were being built in Manhattan, the description was the edifice complex. Right? Each person had to outbuild the next. So we have such things. We know them. In Teaneck, it's just the houses. So the point is, unless some shul has to outshine the next shul, we're going to build our sukkah taller than yours. So it's not going to come up very often. But the psak is, anyway, that above 20 amos is psula under all circumstances. Yes?
The Waldorf and Yerushalayim, they have, like, their sukkah is built into the building. The sky is really high up.
Well, hopefully, it's... I mean, 20 amos is pretty tall. You have to assume, let's say, 33, 34 feet, is like, you know, 3 to 4 stories of a building. That's pretty tall. Just, you know, in the morning, lift the shades for him. Okay? For a moment. Don't blind me. Right, imagine, you know, from the ground level, you're talking about, you know, count, you know, 4 stories up. They're probably, first hall is probably not more than 10 feet a story. So by the time you get to like halfway up the 4th story, that's how tall the sukkah would have to be to psula. Now, I've never seen the sukkah there. I'd be surprised. I mean, it would be pretty funny if someone was trying to outdo the next guy and built a sukkah psula. Right? It's one of those beautiful things, like the people who sell their kalim for Pesach because they're so machmir, so they don't want to just sell the chametz, they want to sell the kalim too. And when they sell the metal and glass kalim, they buy them back after Pesach. Well, guess what? You have to do tefillah again because you bought it from a guy. But... That proves that the Rebonishlom has a sense of humor. All right, let's talk a little bit about this brisa. So that's what's relevant for the Gemara, for this sugya. And let me introduce our discussion about Tosefta and the brisa in general with a very important caveat. This particular issue is one which is of interest, might have been of interest to certain kinds of achronim, who are more interested in this a little bit, and is certainly the focus or the preoccupation of modern academic scholarship, of looking at the brises in different sources and then drawing conclusions. Now, the conclusions traditional interpreters might have drawn, I would say they didn't draw conclusions, they imposed conclusions sometimes. So some of you might have noticed someone asked me in Seder about a comment the Gra makes on one of the passages in our Tosefta print in the back, where they say the Gra made an amendment to the Tosefta. And how did the Gra make that amendment? Correct. And most of the Hagos Hagra, when he's making Hagos, you know, especially on Tosefta and Netza, are like that. Methodologically, it's something that scholarship rejects, and I actually think scholarship has happened to be correct on this one. It's not that all Hagos are wrong, but you have to remember that all you have to do is look at the Yerushalmi and realize that more often than not, when you have a Tosefta, it will look like the version of the Braisa in the Yerushalmi rather than the version of the Braisa in the Bavli. The impact of this upon issues of halacha is nothing. This is the general question. One of the enterprises of the academic world in academic Talmud, and sometimes, but not always, with very disrespectful tones, is to, you know, take Mishnayos and claim that the Amoraim didn't understand the intent of the Mishnah, or take statements in Amoraim and say that the Stam of the Gemara didn't understand the intent of the Amora. And I'll state this very clear at the outset. I do not find such a notion to be heretical or very problematic either. I do find the tone of which it's often, I find two things troubling. I find particularly troubling sometimes the tone in which it's spoken about, a tone of condescension. And it's fair to say that I would have taken, or to borrow the Gemara I quoted on Thursday, that Umale Ata David of Hushol said, I would have destroyed 1,000 of you before him. Most of these people, all of these people who speak in such a manner, I would just say that the Katanam Shel, the Amoraim, and the Misadri Hashas are Ava Mimasnam. So the only reason why it's possible to even be relatively certain about certain things is because we have sometimes, Basrai have later sources that the earlier people didn't have. So one problem I have, and this should never be found in someone who's from the world of the Beis Medrash, is an improper attitude in dealing with these things. The second thing which bothers me sometimes is the certitude with which certain conclusions are reached about what's going on. And keep in mind, by the way, that it's not that this methodology was invented by modern scholars. There are times that Rishonim, especially the Baalei HaTosafot, will make such an utterance. But as you know, the Baalei HaTosafot had nothing but utter reverence for Chazal and the interpreters of the Bavli. But sometimes human beings make mistakes. So I have a rule when we talk about this. I have a rule for intellectual reasons, but also for religious reasons, which is when you talk about this, you don't say that the Gemara misunderstood what the Amora said. What you say is the Gemara either reinterpreted or understood it differently. And I say that for two reasons. Number one, because of respect for Chachamim. And number two, because sometimes I suspect it's not a misunderstanding. It's a deliberate reinterpretation. And let me give you sort of a mashal. Convention has it, the famous question that the Keseth Mishnah asks, it's in the beginning of the second parak of Hilchos Mamrim, which is, why if the rule is Hilchos HaKevasrai, and the Rambam says that any Sanhedrin, even if one which is lesser Bechachma of a minyan, can overturn the Deoraisa interpretations, not always the Rabbanans, but the Deoraisa interpretations of previous generations, because the Ela Shofet Asher Yiyah Bayamim Ahim, Ein Lecha Shofet Ela Shabiyamecha, so the Kesef Mishnah asks, why couldn't the Amoraim argue on the Tanai? Hilchos HaKevasrai. And more than that, they were allowed to, each based in its own dar. So the Kesef Mishnah's answer is that, in a Chanami, they could have, but they accepted they weren't going to. It was a convention. The Amoraim agreed they would not argue on something that was the sole opinion amongst the Tanai. Not because they weren't able to, but because they chose not to. Now, what I would like to suggest, and I'm sure I'm not the first one who suggested it, is that sometimes there are Amoraic interpretations of Tanaitic sources which are forced interpretations. That happens often. We can recognize that. And the reason it's forced is because you're not allowed to argue on the Mishnah, but you can interpret differently. Now, that's not every interpretation of a Tannaitic source amongst the Amoraim that seems forced is because of this. Probably most are not. Many times the Amoraim have alternate textual traditions that we don't have. And there's a reason why they're saying what they're saying. But I think it is certainly possible that there are times where the Amoraim choose deliberately to interpret the Tannaim, not following original intent, as a way of arguing, but you're not allowed to argue, so you have to at least be able to fit it into the words. And I don't doubt that there are some times that the Stam of the Gemara, even when their interpretation might not be, again, assuming that we have a basis for assuming so, might not be the original intent of the Amoraim, it may not be because they don't know, it may be because they're choosing to sort of interpret in a different fashion. Now, one last comment, then I'll answer it, Tavira, which is, how do we have the chutzpah and the gumption to think that we would have a better understanding of the Tannaim than the Amoraim did, or a bit more importantly, more commonly, a better understanding of the Maimers of the Amoraim than the Misadrei HaShas did? We live hundreds, thousands of years later than they did. We're much removed from those circumstances. How do we have the chutzpah? Let's assume we consider ourselves intellectual peers. How do we have the chutzpah to argue? So the answer is, number one, we sometimes think for ourselves and we see different things. But more importantly, number two, there are two sources that we might have that the Misadrei HaShas of a given sugya did not have, which may mean simply that we have more information available to us than they did. What are those two sources? Number one is the Yerushalmi. And number two are other sugyos in Shas. Bale Atosis, when they employ this method, are typically actually looking at other sugyos in Shas. And we'll point, for example, the Rav Papa on the last Amud in Bava Basra, the way, way end, Rav Papa says that Milva Alpe Govim in Hayorshim, Ve'eno Govim in Alekuchos. Govim in Hayorshim for reason X, Ve'eno Govim in Alekuchos for reason Y. When you look at the parallel in Kiddushin in the first parak, when Rav Papa paskins, Hilchasa Milva Alpe Govim in Hayorshim, Ve'eno Govim Lekuchos, the same sa. And then, when the reasons are given, the reasons are different. Tosfos, there, atop Tosfos on Kuf Ayin Vavam and Aleph, says that there's no stira here. Rav Papa, in both cases, only said, Hilchasa, Milval Peh Govim and Ayorshim, Veina Govim and Lakuchos. The interpretation of what that means is not from Rav Papa's words. That's from the Gemara's words. The Shas is what Tosfos typically calls it. And there's a machlokus between two sugyos as to what Rav Papa meant. Which means, by the way, obviously, Rav Papa presumably only meant one of those two things. There was a machlokus. Did somebody have a mesorah, or was it just an interpretation? I don't know. And Tosfos says you find that a lot of times in Shas. Tosfos is very important because he's highlighting the importance of recognizing when a statement of an Amora ends and when the Perush of the Gemara begins. Now, 95% of the time, when you draw the distinction between the Memra of the Amora, as they call it, and the Stam of the Gemara, it doesn't matter, because you don't have a better interpretation, and you don't have reason to suggest another interpretation. But if you happen to have another sugya, or if you happen to have Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, who Eretz Yisrael Amoraim and Yerushalmi quoted one way, and understood one way, and in the Bavli it's understood differently, it's clear, it's not a tradition, at least in the Bavli, it's not what Rabbi Yochanan actually said, it's the Bavli's interpretation of what Rabbi Yochanan said. And that's how you might possibly have an alternative interpretation. Not because you're smarter than the Misadrim or you can understand better, it's because you have a source that they might not necessarily have had available to them. But again, I think in many cases it's not even a misunderstanding. I think they may have well known, and yet they're choosing to interpret differently because they think that we follow a different particular path. And then when people ask me, and I bring that back to this discussion about the Braisa, what impact does this have upon the Halacha? The answer is none, because we paskin like the Misadrei HaBavli as they presented the Halacha, not like the Amoraim, not like the Tannaim, and not as we interpret them. We paskin like the Amoraim and the Tannaim as interpreted by the Shas. Okay. Kasser.
When you say that the Bale Tosfos had access to other Mesechtos, are you saying
we in the Bale Tosfos? In other words, it could be the Misad. Yeah, I'm sorry, finish.
Are you saying that the Bale Tosfos were like looking at another Masechta and this Masechta at the same time, and they saw something that didn't necessarily match up, and so they brought a question from that?
That's how the Bale Tosfos made their living. From stiras between different Masechtas, different sugyas.
That's assuming that the people that are talking in the Bavli weren't aware of what was said in the other Masechta?
Sometimes that's the case. For example, There are five mesechtas that are usually assumed to have been edited in a different yeshiva than the rest of Shas, like Nazir, I don't remember if Nadarim is one of them, a few of them are the rest are in Kachim. So in other words, it is possible that not every mesad there had every sugya in front of him. Yes. And it's possible that sugyas were mesudaros in two different people in two different places, and they came up with different ways of presenting the sugya. So the answer is yes, that's possible. And again, Tosfos would say, in some cases, that it was a machlokas between two mesadrim as to how to understand, let's say, Rav Papa. So yes. But yes, we do not assume necessarily that everybody, you don't have to assume that everybody in the editorial process had access to everything. Yehuda. We don't know. They didn't leave their names on there. You know, you could call them Rabbanan Savarai because it makes it happy. And do we know who Rabbanan Savarai were? They were people who came after the Amorai and before the Gaonim.
We don't have any records that they left behind besides the fact that they edited their
book. All we have is our Shas. Yeah. We wouldn't even know Rabbanan Savarai if not for the fact that the Gaonim had a tradition that, like Rosh Shri Gaon, refers to Rabbanan Savarai.
And also we assume there were rabbis in between
them. Yeah, they were guys. The Gaonic period. It was the Gaonic period. Except for, you have to go and look and see. Those of you who are interested in the most traditional presentation, not of everything that I said, but of the first attempt at rabbinic historiography, first or second attempt, in the post-Talmudic period, was the Igeres of Rav Shura Gaon. The Igeres of Rav Shura Gaon is really interesting, but it has two parts. The part that's really interesting is the first part, which is his reconstruction of the history of rabbinic literature. He was asked by the people of Kairouan about who wrote the Mishnah, who wrote the Gemara, and some other questions, it seems, in relationship to that. And the second half is a list of the Gaonic chronologies, of who were the Gaonim, who ruled over the academies, you know, one after the other after the other. And that's actually a very important source for information of, you know, most of these Gaonim, I suspect, we've never heard of. We know of only the famous Gaonim, like probably Shura Gaon, or Hai Gaon, or Sadia Gaon, or, you know, and whoever wrote the Bahag, or Yudai Gaon, whoever it was. We don't know of too many Gaonim otherwise.
It was probably Gaonim who edited it?
Well, again, how do you distinguish? So that's why I want you to go look there. It's your homework. Go look there. Go to the library and look up the Igeres of Shura Gaon and see what is the date of the first Gaon.
There's one Igeres of Shura Gaon that I can find.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you what the best edition is. Binyan Menashe Levine's edition, which the library will have, it prints the Spanish and French recensions side by side. But you go to the second half and look at that, yeah. So, but probably any version should do for this. The English translation, I think, by Rabinowitz should do also. It should be fine. Devere. Really?
Yeah.
I would love if you could find that source. Azebarashekivanti.
Yeah.
There's also been a dissertation or a thesis, a master's thesis written by Dr. Neil Danzig at Revel on the subject of Chasuri Mechasra, between Bavli versus Yerushalmi. Okay? By the way, one of the things I'll say without knowing about this is you don't find probably Chasuri Mechasra in the Yerushalmi. Right? It's a specifically Babylonian way of approaching the Mishnah. Let me add another just to this comment. I mentioned in Seder and Shir. Do you notice the difference between Rav's statements and the Amoraim statements that follow? Rav says, Lo Shanu. Rav is he's a Talmud of the editors of the Mishnah. Rav is telling you about the scope of the Mishnah. He's not giving a reason for the din. He's starting actually by telling you, he's really adding information to the Mishnah about its scope, as opposed to now darshaning the reason, number one. Number two, Rav, in many cases, there were multiple copies of Mishnayos that floated around. I say multiple copies. There were different editions of the Mishnah early. Levi had his own Mishnah. Levi was a student of Rebbe, right? But you have Masnisa de Levi. He had a slightly version. He was making certain emendation. There are times where Rav, if I'm not mistaken, in the Mishnah, instructs his Tana. What's a Tana? Yeah, there are two meanings of the words Amorayim and Tanayim. A Tana could either be, and they both are found in the Gemara, a Tana can either be like Tutanoi, meaning a rabbinic sage of the Mishnaic era. A Tana was also a fellow hung around in the Mishnaic era whose job was to memorize verbatim Mishnayos and Brisos and so on, and to recite them when needed in the base matters. He might not have been very smart, but he had a good memory. Many of them were blind. And then there are many mentions of blind Tanaim in Chishnah, which is not surprising because blind people tend to have a very much better, you know, oral memory in both spellings of the word oral. And two meanings of Amora. Amora can either be a rabbinic sage, like Amoraihu v'aliba d'rav, or an Amora could be the microphone. And that's when a Chacham got up to give a drasha, either because it wasn't his kavod or he didn't necessarily was voice trained, he would quietly tell the Amora what to say, sentence by sentence, and the Amora would project it to the large audience. The expression is Rav Uki Ale Amora Vidarash. What does that mean? It means he set up an Amora. It's like today, they set up a microphone. For him, that was his microphone. Okay. By the way, there's a very... one of the questions that comes along with this is, can you give pshat in the Gemara against the halacha, against the received interpretation? There is the Groha and the Talmud, I think, with Ephraim Margolios. I only know one thing. I once heard Rosh Hashanah quoted a long time ago. Some of you may have learned the first mission about Metziah. Shnayim ochas and betala. Zeh omer kula shalei v'zeh omer kula shalei. Zeh shava shein lo b'pachin v'chetzeh v'zeh shava shein lo b'pachin v'chetzeh. And yachaloku. Zeh omer kula shalei v'zeh omer chetzeh shalei. Okay? And so on and so forth. The Gemara asks Akasha, Shnayim ochas and betalas. Zeh omer kula shalei v'zeh omer kula shalei. And so the question is, if Shnayim ochas and betalas, so why do you need to tell us? I think that's the way it goes in the Gemara. Zeh omer kula shalei v'zeh omer kula shalei. So the Gemara gives a whole thing. The opening sugya, which might be Rabbanan Savarai or something like that, gives a whole discussion about this, about the structure of the Mishnah. And apparently his Talmud just said, pshat in the Mishnah is the following. Shnayim ochas and betalas, colon. Scenario number one. Zeomer kula shalei v'zeomer kula shalei, dot, dot, dot. Scenario number two. Zeomer kula shalei v'zeomer mechza shalei, dot, 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 dot. Right, so in other words, okay, I'm upset on that. So thank you, and Devir, you had a second point.
A second question. In terms of why are we asking Bavli and Bavli, would you just...
Why are we bound by the Bavli in the first place?
Well, that's what I'm going to ask.
That is a longer discussion. There are multiple opinions offered, and I'm going to tell you what I believe is the correct opinion, which is the Rambam in his Hakdamot of Mishneh Torah, who says, because Klal Yisrael accepted it. Klal Yisrael was unified enough at a certain point to accept everything in the Bavli. Every Beis Din that makes the Takana subsequently isn't necessarily binding on the entire Tzibur because not everybody accepts the authority of that Beis Din. No. The Rambam doesn't say they had a signer. No, he just said, I would say Klal Yisrael accepted it. That, by the way, explains, I believe, even though that's not necessarily why they're thinking in those terms, the way I've said many times, the only time you say, we know a famous question, when do you say by Exera? Bat latam, bat lagzera. And when do you say afal pisha bat latam, lo bat lagzera? Because you need a minyan acher latira. The answer to the question is correct. When enough people observing Klal Yisrael do it, and the rabbanim of Klal Yisrael, rabbinic leadership says it's okay because in this case the reason doesn't apply. That when it becomes kasha. Simchas Torah is coming. You're going to dance, Tavir?
No.
So I might not, I know, Daniel's, your Chavrus's father, you know, and I have the competition for who's the bigger Simchas Torah Grinch. The only day Dr. Goldstein is at Hashkama is Simchas Torah. It makes for a lot of fun. But it's not because he holds that you're not allowed to dance on Shabbos or Yom Tov. It's a personality thing. You know what they say about Litvaks? You know, why is it that we read four psukim in the Megillah in the Eicha Trap? So that even the Litvaks should have fun. So why don't we read the entire thing in the Eicha Trap? That would be Leitzanus. So the answer is, so the Rama quotes two reasons. One is, Mutav Sheyu Shogon Yu Mizidin, and the other Teretz Devir is, no, we're not Bekiya Metiko and Klei Shir. Tell me something. If we're not Bekiya Metiko and Klei Shir, and therefore the Xeris doesn't apply, why can't I play the piano on Shabbos? The reason you can't play the piano is the same reason you can't dance. Shami Yisak and Klei Shir. If the reason doesn't apply in one, why not another? The answer is, because Jews in northern France, the Gemara already says Jews were violated. The Gemara says, Mutav Sheyu Shogon Yu Mizidin, about singing, clapping, and dancing. And the Gemara says it's awesome, but Mutav. Tosa says, yeah, but what about us? Because we're from. So it says, ah, we're not Bakim B'tikin Klishir, so the Gzera doesn't apply to us at all. So the answer is what? They looked around and decided they wanted to liven things up in dark, cold northern Europe on Simchas Torah? No. It's because people were doing it. And the Baal HaTosfos said, we're from community, it must be mutter. People weren't playing musical instruments. So the answer is, Davar Shibba Minyan Sarach Minyan Achar Latiro. The Minyan that answered was that Klal Yisrael was a Makabel, the authority of the Bali. If Klal Yisrael has decided that Gzera doesn't apply in this case, that's the Minyan Achar Latiro. That's in a short, in a nutshell. So I'm going to leave it at that. We'll leave it at that for now. Okay, so let's, yes, Noam?
I was going to say, why can't we have like national referendums?
So the answer is we could if everybody agreed. I will tell you this, and I don't want to say anything more on this. I struggled with listen, there is a profound challenge to rabbinic Judaism as practiced by us, which are we have a lot of gzeiros whose reasons don't apply anymore, and we have many things we should be gozer on that we can't, because we don't have the power to make gzeiros. A simple answer, simple example, stam yenam. If it were today, what you would do is you would prohibit drinking any alcohol in the presence of a non-Jew, but you would permit buying wine produced in the Napa Valley. No guy is menaseh today in this country. Even if they're over there, nobody's menasek in that. The Eucharist might be actually Mamash Yai Nesek. But that's in a very limited context. You know that's not what they did with the bottles in Napa Valley. And just because I buy a commercially produced bottle of wine, I'm not going to marry the vintner's daughter. I don't know who he is, and I don't care. On the other hand, it should be also to walk into a bar and to drink. You know, the Ramah prohibits beer only if it's date beer, I believe, or something maybe Mashke Dvash. He limits the Gzera extremely. But really, we should prohibit drinking alcohol in all contexts with non-Jews. For reasons being totally honest, we have the power to do neither. But people complain much more about that we have these gzeiros that don't apply. And it bothered me for a long time. One of my rabbis once said, and I don't agree with this, they say in the name of the Gra, and again, a lot of things are said in the name of the Gra, but Gra didn't say. I wasn't there because of you. If you look, by the way, did you see, there was a video my wife showed me about Rav Kanievsky, about the hurricane. And you realize, firstly, the disrespect people have for Gedolei Torah, right? He said one word. Somebody was describing the situation. First time a guy in Yiddish, another guy in Hebrew. And the question is, should people evacuate before Shabbat? Well, it's not clear what they asked him. And he said, Sakana. And they literally, you saw them walk away. Oh. And from that, they concluded, he said, you should flee before Shabbos. Right? You talk about manipulating people and disrespect. So you never know when people use somebody else for their agenda. So a lot of things said in the name of the Gra. But the svar that was said was that Dinam Derabanan had both Nistar and Nigla. Now, this Teretz, if it was said by anyone, the Gra, anybody else, is an attempt to explain why it's not irrelevant. Right? It's dealing with a very serious question. The problem I have with it is that I've never seen a tshuva poskim who deal with the din derabanan and are trying to find the het there and say, well, I would have been matir in this case because the gzera was never made there, because the reason was not shayach there, but I'm mistayeg because there might be a nistar reason. I've never seen a poskim write that way. So poskim don't work with that assumption. They work with the assumption is that when the din derabanan, the reason is spelled out, now you have to work within the system to decide whether the gzera was a broad gzera, even if the reason doesn't apply, or whether it wasn't, and how you could sort of work with that. Nobody, I never ever seen somebody said I was going to be matir, except I was afraid there was a reason al pi hanistar. Now,
doesn't the Rosh Hashanah talk about it regarding
Chol? No, you can say what's that? No,
there was a story with the. People troubling the inn.
No, that was just that people made mistakes. They thought it was physically kosher milk, and it was just exerin and yorin. It turned out they were drinking treif mamish. And they came to him, oy vey, what did we do? Right? No, he didn't say that. Nothing to do with nistar and nigla. If someone assered, someone could say that sometimes the Gemara gives one reason, there might be multiple reasons for exera. But that is certainly not a general response. So I struggled with this question for a very long time. And then I finally, in the last couple of years, and I think I may have said this in a panel that I presented with Rabbi Clapper at Mount Sinai, I finally understood why. We actually want things that way. It's very strange. We want things that way? The answer is yes. Because in order to be able to matir gzeira, we would need to sacrifice something that is very, very precious and dear to us. You have a shayla, you come to me. You go to your Mara the Asra. And I can give you an answer to the question. And maybe some people agree with me and some people disagree with me. But I understand your circumstance maybe better than somebody 6,000 miles away. And that's what you get to do. You get to choose the Chacham you ask your questions to. Right? It comes with a tremendous responsibility to choose wisely. But nonetheless, that's something we like. you wouldn't like it if you came to me and explained the difficult situation. You know, and it had various elements of hashkafic elements that played into it as well. And I'm accepting this a tzorach gadol because of this reason. And I want to tell you mutter, but I'm bound. I can't tell you anything because the Sanhedrin said no. Right? What we get, what we have is a great degree of autonomy. Rabbinic autonomy. Rabbis like this too, by the way. Make no mistake about it. Nobody likes being overturned. It's not that I don't go to my Rebbe with questions. Not like, you know, but nonetheless, we have a notion that a talmud chacham is done lefimash ein avros. At a certain point, if someone has learned sufficiently and knows sufficiently, they can make certain kinds of decisions and answer certain kinds of questions. Now, we like that. We like our autonomy. The only way, but what unites Klal Yisrael is the Talmud Bavli. Now, in reverse, right? Not because we accepted it and everybody accepted it as the ground rules, we know that nobody drinks Stam Yenim. Right, we know that. We play by the same rules. You know what would happen if I got up and I decided, or somebody gets up and he decides, Stam Yenim isn't really Shayach to us anymore. We now have two communities because we can't eat each other's food. Not because, you know, not because my yarmulke is of a certain variety and I don't trust someone or your yarmulke wears a certain way, but literally because we're not two different religions. The baseline is Dina de Gemara. And the price you pay for wanting to undo Xeros is to have a central authority and sacrifice your autonomy. And I don't think the people who complain about the Xeros so much are running to sacrifice their autonomy. In other words, it's a double-edged sword, and if you want one, you have to have the other. And in order to get the other, you want to change the Xeros on Stam Yenim? I think that would be a wonderful thing, but it means everyone would have to sacrifice their autonomy to do that. And that's not... I think that if you step back and think about that, I think most of Klal Yisrael, and I think across the Orthodox world, I don't, from left to right, I think even on the right, they don't identify personal autonomy as a value the way some modern Orthodox Jews might, but nonetheless, they like the certain kind of communal autonomy that they have in terms of Psak Halacha. And nobody really wants to give that up, unless they're the one making all the decisions. Here. Ilan, sorry.
So going back to the editing of the Gemara, so basically, beyond sort of a fuzzy kind of sense, we don't really know about like who edited which Pesach code and what.
Correct. I mean, probably there were probably two major schools because most of the Shas is pretty uniform except for these five Pesach codes. Morty.
So in terms of the Mesach Shas, where do like Rabina and Rav Ashi fit into that?
From a historical perspective, so this is a piece that's thorny for some people, but it really shouldn't. The Gemara, some say, like the Rambam writes, that Ravina Rav Ashi completed the Shas. So firstly, it would be Ravina, because he was later than Rav Ashi. But the truth, the Gemara never actually says that. The Gemara in Bava Metzia just says, Rebbe V'Rav Nosson Sof Mishnah, Ravina Rav Ashi Sof Hora. So the Rambam takes that to mean, and others do, that they finish the Gemara. If you read the Geras Rosh Shriragon, Dr. Elman has pointed out, it's quite clear he did not assume. Firstly, it probably wasn't Rav Ashi. It was probably Rav Yossi, a later Amar. And when he describes Rav Ashi's great works, and Rav Shriragon goes on at great length, relatively great length in the Igeres, about all of Rav Ashi's accomplishments, and you know what he says about Siddur HaShas? Nothing. So the Gaonim certainly, it would seem, did not assume that they were the finishers. They're amongst the latest Amoraim mentioned by name. And whatever Sof Hora means, I don't know. But they are not the ones actually responsible Siddur HaShas. It doesn't really matter. It's Mabakah. Okay, so I'm not going to go much further other than to say that we're going to be looking, and I gave you during Seder, and we'll start in the beginning of Shir tomorrow, I gave you, if you look at the sheet for a moment, and again, most of you, I think, already spent some time working on it, I gave you, first on top, the four manuscripts of the Tosefta. I will introduce them a little bit tomorrow, of what those manuscripts are. And then, below, I took on the right my own amalgamated version of the Tosefta. Since the Tosefta's versions are virtually identical, I added in a couple of words that Xavier Vienna was missing. And then I compared it against a version of the Braisa found in the Yushalmi, the Defus, which is printed in the back of the Gemara. There's a reason I did that, even though it is virtually identical to the Vienna manuscript. I mean, everything, all the Tosefta witnesses, the three manuscripts, the first printing, the Defus Rishon, I'll explain tomorrow, and the Defus printed Vilna, printed in the back of your Shas, are virtually identical. And then the Yushalmi and the Bavli, which are not virtually identical to one another, or even to the Tosefta. Which would you say, by the way, is closer to the Tosefta, the Yushalmi or the Bavli? From your experience, not from anything I've said.
Yeah. I have no experience of having to go.
That's all I'm looking at. In this particular case,
Yerushalmi
is much closer. As Bederach Klal, it is the case. I'll tell you already, because there's no point in telling you tomorrow, because this is not a good example. There are times where the manuscripts of the Tosefta seem to have been edited towards the Bavli, particularly Ksav Yad Erfurt, much less so Ksav Yad Vienna. If I'm not mistaken, you have to check. I think that's one of the reasons why Lieberman, when he did his Tosefta, and he only got through Bava Basra, and the Bavas were published posthumously, so the Bavas are much thinner, the commentary. I believe one of the reasons Lieberman chose Vienna, even though it's from a century later than Erfurt, is because Erfurt shows some of the tendencies of its scribe having sort of been correcting the Tosefta towards the version found in the Bavli. But as a general rule, even in Kolzeh, what we have in our, certainly in our manuscripts of the Tosefta and the Dufus Rishon, and even a little less in the printed in the Vilna, because what happened in the Vilna edition of the Tosefta, what happened? Thereafter, they were trying to amend it to match the Bavli, but they tend to be much closer to the Yerushalmi version of the Braisa than the Bavli's version of the Braisa. Right? So that's what we'll pick up tomorrow. We'll talk about our specific instance. I'll give you a little bit of information about the Tosefta itself. And yeah.